Afterward, the long road from Peon to Amazon Whole Foods. That corpse you planted last year in your garden, has it begun to sprout? Will it bloom this year? You, hypocrite reader, my fellow, my brother. Baudelaire, translated within Eliot's The Wasteland. Almost exactly 1 year after my last visit with the LPN in Thailand, I learned that activist investor Jana Partners has acquired 8% of Whole Foods stock. It will be the first step in a series of events that lead the internet giant Amazon to swallow the grocer whole. It is a deal that is portrayed with an almost eschatological force in the trades, and perhaps appropriately so. With it, retail grocery feels like it is closing in on some type of endpoint, almost a bathroom drain-style singularity through which all supply chain consultants must pass before being evaporated to the cloud. In many ways, and however earth-shattering, it is one of the least surprising developments of this book. Focusing on Amazon Whole Foods is completely missing the narrative, Earl Schweizer tells me. These changes have been going on behind the scenes for quite a while. Earl is one of the very few in the position to know. For a moment, he was Whole Foods grocery in a literal embodied sense, the head of the national grocery program for the entire chain, a man at the helm of some 80 categories, and ultimately responsible for the buying, pricing, and shelf allocation of tens of thousands of products in the store's most profitable sector. Then, after 14 years, he jumped ship. Earl is a little tough to get right. He is sharp, in the elbow sense as much as the analytic one. There's a receding hairline buzzed down to skull, a crinkly smile, and he talks quick. He's not actually small, but there's a little man inside of him, ready to jump out and lunge at you anytime he's challenged. I think there's something essential about the insecurity. Earl came up in grocery the old-fashioned way. My parents didn't have money, but I had a young family right out of college. It was work or starve, so I decided to work my ass off, he tells me. Which means he began on the retail floor, moved on to ring registers, stock shelves, and managed the night shift. It was a slow climb, but one where he worked in almost every aspect of the industry before hitting the corporate suites. Now, in his life after Whole Foods, he sits on the board of national retailers and advises dozens of multi-million-dollar suppliers. He's the stock boy who made good, and he can speak to both sides of the retail divide, as in it actually comes out of his mouth in the language he uses, toggling between an earnest grocer from the Bronx and a guy who spent a little too much time on corporate retreats. Once he tells me, "Look, I'm a big-mouth Jew from New York. That makes me an asset in innovation culture and an asshole in maintenance culture." And I really couldn't capture the divide in Earl any better. But the beautiful thing about that path and divide, about Earl really, is that as he grew, he never detached. He knows how hard those jobs are, and is one of the few people who can compare the 80-hour work week in the boardroom to the 80-hour work week on the retail floor and call bullshit on all those who are convinced that the latter is replaceable and the former requires a sainted level of intelligence and expertise. He's also just cynical enough about how business actually gets done that I get the impression that he actually gives a shit. I'm wary about this at first. He feeds me line after line about Tikkun Olam, the Jewish duty to repair the world, and it sounds a little like another one of those innovation buzzwords. But when he rattles off the planks of the Whole Foods mission, he's quick to say which have been abandoned and which are still limping by in a way that seems nuanced and fair. And his outrage at the intrusions of private equity, their insistence on applying a values equals price equation to his Whole Foods, where value meant a compendium of qualities that included treating people well, is unfakeable in the way it subsides from stream-of-consciousness rant to fidgety bitterness. Which is to say, on a kind of profound level, I come to believe Earl really cares about using grocery to make the world a better place. And I believe that's why he got out. At one point, going on and on about his attempts to source chocolate without slave labor, a process just as agonizingly difficult as it is with Thai shrimp, he says, "Look, anyone can do this with their life. It amounts to seeing the world and being creative about how you engage with it. I just happen to have a platform in grocery, and so that's how I made my impact." I meet him at the Whole Foods Bowery, the same store where I worked the seafood counter, and one of many that Earl helped build from scratch. When we walk the aisles together, there's something faintly touching going on. Earl reaching out to products like their old friends, pausing to tell a story about their launch, turning the box over in his hands, checking how sourcing decisions and prices have changed before moving on to greet the next one. a man wandering through some vast family reunion, slightly estranged and overwhelmed. As we talk through his history with the chain, this dynamic continues. Earl swings between we, they, and me so frequently in a single sentence, it moves from being disorienting to speaking clearly about the emotion of being outside something that was once your own. And his negative comments about structure are almost immediately followed by praise of personnel, a veritable grocery list of people he wants to make sure I understand he loves and learned from. Nevertheless, all the love and learning could not prevent Earl from leaving in early 2016, directly after Andy, my ginger-bearded trainer, along with 5,000 other employees who got the axe, almost exactly a year ahead of the merger with Amazon. The timing wasn't an accident. It was the first stage in a trend. For most of its history, Whole Foods was a highly decentralized company. They put their authority in their 12 regions, each of which acted with a unique level of autonomy when it came to deciding what to sell and how to price. There are historical reasons for this. Much of Whole Foods' growth came through acquisition rather than new store development. And there are deeper philosophical ones. The chain is far more Texas libertarian than it ever was East Coast liberal. The early organic movement, itself an outgrowth of late 60s counterculture, was a band of outsiders, the loners, seekers, and impassioned weirdos of the food world, who saw government as not just failing to regulate agriculture, but corrupt as an instrument. Footnote. This libertarianism got tempered at Whole Foods by its early expansion to California. As the chain grew and early hires came up through the ranks to senior management, they brought their state's famously caretaker, progressive, slightly paternalistic values with them. This created the hybrid, quote, conscious capitalist machine that would barnstorm through the upper middle class kitchen, able to gratify the self, save Mother Nature, and delight Wall Street at the very same time. But it shocked nobody who knew the chain when CEO and founder John Mackey came out against universal healthcare and retail unions. End footnote. And at Whole Foods, the decentralized structure was critical. It brought buyers closer to the ground, allowing them to keep a better eye on quality, earning the chain a deserved reputation among entrepreneurs as the best place to premier young brands. Its genuinely local procurers wielded their authority to waive promotional fees, give advice on logistics, and otherwise nurture the products they personally loved and believed would help the earth. But then, the rest of the industry caught up. Whole Foods' very success allowed the products they premiered to scale up, and once at scale, flee over to Target and its ilk, those massive chains that operated with a buying power and efficiency the Whole Foods' decentralized structure couldn't match. And rather than double down on their strengths and continue to innovate, and since we're far from a sustainable world, it seems there's plenty of room left to innovate, Whole Foods decided to stand pat. And when you're suddenly playing the same game against everyone else, you play it on their terms, which means you have to compete on price and convenience. To do that, you have to get big. And you don't get much bigger than Amazon. It's a middle finger to what Whole Foods stands for, a supplier who still sells to the chain tells me. Big centralized buying is the opposite of Whole Foods, a giant fuck you to quality standards. Ian Keller, co-founder of Peeled Snacks, noticed the same thing from the outside. One by one, I started seeing all the good, smart people leaving. Whole Foods was the leader in progressive activism in the food industry. Then somewhere by mid-2016, everyone I knew doing that type of work got sacked. Or as Earl puts it, I'd say they're no longer really interested in the conscious part of conscious capitalism because it didn't get them to where they wanted to be in terms of price. And so, at the same time Ian was noticing the best and most idealistic people leaving from the outside, Earl watched from the inside as they were replaced by a new type of hire. These were people from Home Depot, Walmart, and Target. They have talents, Earl tells me. They do certain things really well, but they aren't always the type of things that line up with Whole Foods' core values. We always said, if you're trying to be the cheapest, there are two stakeholder groups who are going to pay for it, your employees and your suppliers, he continues. With the Prime deals, they're just sending the bill to the suppliers. It's actually kind of gross. We're going to do a 10% deal and you pay for it. It's the opposite of the way we used to do business. Whole Foods has retreated so rapidly from their value of win-win partnerships, it is stunning. It all reminds me of something that aquaculture researcher Corey Pete told me when we talked about Thai shrimp farmers. Corey sketched to me what he called a pillar of sustainability. All these NGOs talk about people, profits, and the planet, Corey said. But for it to actually work, all three of those need to be equal. Our current model does a good job at maximizing profits. But to the extent that it works to protect the planet, which it often tries to do very faithfully, it almost always comes out of people. When I relay this to Earl, he pauses. That's not quite how I see it. For me, the question is, do you want to win a race to the bottom? Or do you want to deliver the highest quality and be the best? Everybody has pressure from the competition. Always will. But it's how you respond. It can't just be about cutting things back. Humanity can't just play defense. We need a good offense, too. We get quiet for a moment, and I wonder what that offense would look like, what it demands of its customers, and whether it's incompatible with the abundance grocery promises. Then Earl continues, "The biggest problem in food is the financial community. They don't get any retail dynamics outside of price comparisons. It's not how they're trained to look at the world, and so they totally miss it. But this stuff is obvious to people who actually work on the ground. Once you start chasing price downhill, it rewards the worst practices." When Earl says this, we're sitting on the second floor balcony of the Whole Foods on the Bowery, munching on two ancient grain salads, looking down at all the men and women sifting through the deals below. And as we munch, we watch them shop. The price comparisons, the picky ingredient scans, the carts filling with unprecedented variety. And I wonder how many of those completely mundane choices map to the worst practices we decry in suppliers, and when exactly they pile up enough to slide downhill and become Peon's problem. Two paths. Back in 1970, Trader Joe Colombe looked at the grocery industry and saw two paths. The first required becoming an active retailer, which for him meant rejecting a passive role as supermarket landlord and applying intensive effort to seek out or create, quote, discontinuous products that could not be imitated by competitors. The second was to grow big, sell goods that are available in infinite supply, and compete ruthlessly on price. This latter path was essentially what every single one of his competitors was attempting. They would spend the next decades scaling up to carry bigger and bigger inventories, gobbling up larger and larger warehouse spaces, forever looking over their shoulders at competitors and trying to shave down costs. He saw his own ruin there. The biggest chain would always win, and however many competed, there could only be one or two that survived to the end. And so, in 1977, he plunged down the riskier track. He slashed inventory, shed warehouse space, and reoriented his entire approach from selling at cheap prices to buying what he believed customers would find outstanding at the price he could sell. I don't want to elevate Trader Joe's too much. For one, the chain has changed significantly since Joe's days, existing now in dilute design, where many continuous goods bask in the halo cast from that earlier image. The very week I wrote this, I went to a Trader Joe's and under new items, found cans of plain seltzer. You simply can't get more mass-produced and continuous than that. For another, even in Joe's heyday, I'm sure things weren't as rosy as his people remember. One of his buyers memorably told me a story about visiting a factory selling extremely profitable, quote, handmade pies that he watched get unloaded from a truck, unboxed, and reboxed into different, more handmade packaging. When he rushed back to tell Joe, the only response was one of those chuckles and, oh, maybe don't go visiting any more suppliers without calling ahead first. But Joe got certain big ideas about humanity and curiosity and individuality right. He looked at the retail landscape and saw that investing in those would allow him to survive, while his competitor's strategy would only allow them to grow more similar. He created a store that bought for people rather than sold to them, creating new products when necessary rather than giving people what they already knew. He pushed his customers to stretch themselves and then led them towards a life they wanted to be leading, even if they did not know it quite yet. He then shrunk his offerings down to a human scale so his buyers could get the expertise needed to actually do all that. Amazon, liberated by the virtual space of the internet, has taken the path Joe surrendered to its logical, almost unrecognizable endpoint. It has no limits on inventory. It insists on the most efficient practices in warehousing. It uses size and scale and efficiency to get the lowest price. It is a pure selling machine. It does not buy for anyone. It buys for everyone at once. And the displaced ideal Amazon caters to is singular, liberty, in the form we most typically worship it these days, convenience. It's an ideal that says with a little help from Amazon, stripping away the hurdles, barriers, inertia, and shipping time from your life, you can finally be free to make the best of your precious time on planet Earth. I saw it first in my prior book. That book looked at the world of yoga and a particularly obsessive practice therein. Men and women who would enter a studio and bend for 8 hours a day. Busy doctors, lawyers, bankers who would sneak off to fit in an hour and a half on their lunch break. In yoga, it was self-betterment, self-improvement, or becoming a stronger, more radiant version of yourself. And in it, I found a whole community based on this ethos, people reveling in the very real ways they had transformed from couch potatoes and addicts, remarking after every class about just how much more capable they felt now. But what was the end? What did you do once you became a better version of yourself? Where did all this self-improvement lead? The answer was always back to more yoga. Never volunteer at a clinic or a food kitchen. Never for a studio owner to open more classes to the poor or injured. Never to take our radiant yoga bodies and put them to use in the service for others. And so those lawyers or doctors would go on to use that extra energy to bend for longer hours. And when they had a vacation, they went off in search of themselves, spiraling deeper and deeper into the practice, becoming ever more capable humans who could push their bodies into ever more drastic positions. In grocery, it all feels eerily similar. Instead of self-improvement, we have the god of convenience and efficiency, which everyone across the system is bending on both knees to serve, from customer to manufacturer and all the increasingly cog-like humans shuffling goods in between. Convenience is the great gift the grocery store gives to the consumer. Efficiency, its great technique for delivering it. But when you make convenience itself an endpoint, what then? In this sense, grocery is a story still being written. In the beginning, there was nature, powerful and cruel, that original destroyer of worlds, drought and predation, wind and disease. And so we built tools to subdue her. From jamming sticks into anthills to charting out agronomist tables and plows. And we built these tools so well and for so long that now nature, real nature, is mostly a dream, an uneasy longing, repressed and turned kindly into submission, the way terrible fathers crumble into grandfathers. Then somewhere, after centuries, we woke to the fact that our tools had become too powerful, our monocultures, pesticides, and mind scalings. The tools just as fearsome as the nature they set out to rein in. And we found ourselves cowering once again. This is the typical endpoint, with our Frankensteins and atomic Godzillas. A daily alienation updated almost as a background app into our iPhone addictions and queasy feelings about social media we just can't quit. But what we've begun to see, what I certainly learned writing this book, is that we've undertaken a new project. We decided that caught between two awesome external forces, nature everlasting, and these new tools of our own creation, the one piece in the whole operation that was most malleable was us, ourselves, that we would happily trade away aspects of our lives, be it community, or duty, or eccentricity, or care, for an ability to survive between them. I came to see this as the very juncture where grocery sits, the store constantly recalibrating as we decide what of ourselves to trade away. To think of it another way, ever since Eric Schlosser and Fast Food Nation came into my life, and of course there was Upton Sinclair and many other muckrakers before him, there's been a very American idea that the closer we look at our food, the more disgusting it will turn out to be. And this always seems to be the case. Every time the best food minds and investigative journalists dig into a particular part of the supply chain, they find some new horror, from slave-grown tomatoes to subsidized corn. It always seems to be there, at bottom, this disgust. But in this book, I've come to see something else in that digging. It is no less horrible, but maybe the slightly sadder form anger takes when balanced by introspection. More of a clawing feeling of being trapped. A revulsion at our own immobility. It is this notion that at the bottom, after all that digging, the particular investigative horror we've uncovered is just a proxy, something closer to a shadow cast off from all of us above peering down and doing the digging. The real object of our scorn might not be in our food safety standards, in the revolving door regulators, in the rise of industry, or even in the abuse and commodification of men. but in ourselves as agents in this world, for knowing what we want and what we are willing to give up to get it, for understanding that this is a moral outrage we've been digging for all along because it verifies what we know but also don't quite want to acknowledge about ourselves. This is to say, the great lesson of my time with groceries is that we have got the food system we deserve. The adage is all wrong. It's not that we are what we eat, it's that we eat the way we are. Retail grocery is a reflection. What people call the supply chain is a long, interconnected network of human beings working on other humans' behalf. It responds to our actions, not our pieties. And in its current form, it demands convenience and efficiency starting from the checkout counter on down. The result is both incredible beyond words, abundance, wish fulfillment, and low price, and as cruel and demeaning as Tun Lin voluntarily choosing to return to those boats. To me, this is as hopeful as it is depressing. We are in dialogue with this world, not at its mercy. We have a natural inclination towards what is right that is as powerful as any selfishness. But for those out there who bristle at this reflection, who want to scream the patently obvious fact that meat is murder, that labor without choice is exploitation, or whatever their own personal horror is, who want to shake the world awake to the fact that we are literally sustaining ourselves on misery, who want to reform, I very much don't want to dissuade you, so much as I want you to consider that any solution will come from outside our food system. So far outside it that thinking about food is only a distraction from the real work to be done. At best, food is an opening, like any mall, that might lead us inside, somewhere darker, more unknowable, a place where the real work of change may finally begin. Climbing out to fresh air. When I talk to Lynn Riles, the trucker, for a final time, our conversation is filled with a new cough that rolls in like a sob. I ask her about Waymo, Google's plan for driverless trucks, and the automating of the industry. And she doesn't even pause to acknowledge the question. They can take my steering wheel out of my cold, dead hands, she says, channeling every cliche I could ever put into her. Then, just a moment later, in response to a question about Bella, her dog, there's a silence so long I wonder if her hands haven't gone cold and dead. I'm going broke, she says, and I don't have a clue what to do. Labor Day comes, and I get a hankering for some salsa, so I head to the website to place an order. Not 5 minutes after clicking send, Julie Boucher writes me personally, Ben, what are you thinking? I canceled your payment, and I'm sending a sampler. I realize I should have known better. Her vigilance and generosity in the name of Slawson knows no bounds. She signs her email with, Have a Slawson day, and I resolve to do just that. In November, when I visit Whole Foods on the Bowery with Earl, we find it has a new seafood case. The old, inconsistent one was ripped out, and a brand new, beautiful counter installed. Who knows what it means for opening metaphors, but Walter's happy about it. He's still working there, no raise, but the rot doesn't accumulate like it used to. Soon after our visit, the newly merged Whole Foods Amazon takes the next logical step in optimization and cuts medical benefits for its part-time workers. Corporate announces this proudly as an effort to create a more equitable and efficient scheduling model. Just after I leave Thailand, major reforms sweep in. Threatened by the media crisis and the prospect of international sanctions, Thailand's military junta begins cracking down. Boats are docked. A new port-in, port-out set of paperwork is brought to the piers. And yet, when I ask those who work in the space whether the reforms will stop the abuse, the answer is a categorical no. Analyst Josh Stride speaks for many when he says, This is a 15-year project. Any retailer who tells you they've snapped their fingers and can give you a clean supply is lying. Others speak to something more depressing than prevarication. Thai producers who have poured themselves into costly reforms only to watch buyers balk at their new prices and seek cheaper product elsewhere. I think you'll see the Thai shrimp industry pay for doing the right thing, one analyst tells me. Earl remains an optimist. When I call to fact check, he tells me, One of the country's biggest positive secrets is how amazing and fascinating the food industry is. People are working their butts off for other people. Amazon and Whole Foods might be chasing price for now, but that just creates an opportunity for someone new to move into the space they abandoned. Finally, Tun Lin. The last time we speak, Something sort of like justice is grinding forth. We are standing in a backyard in Samutsakan, maybe a mile from the docks where he was abducted. It's home now. He's volunteering for the LPN. On his wrist, there's a yellow rubber wrist bracelet of the type I associate with Lance Armstrong. Only this yellow bracelet was given to him to denote his place as a survivor of seafood slavery. He touches it frequently, flipping it around his wrist, back and forth, like the dial of a combination lock he's trying to crack. In the time since I last saw him, he's become one of the few and rare fishermen to see some form of compensation for his time on the boat. He ended up successfully navigating the reparation system, not just because of the 5 years he was trafficked on a boat, but because when he went back of his own volition, he lost his hand. For the first time since meeting him, Tun Lin is smiling. He used the money to return to Myanmar, for the first time since he left at age 15. He's 3 days back now, having just seen his father and mother after 20 years. They wept. His father was shaking. Then Tun Lin used the money from his lump sum earnings to buy them a proper house with concrete floors. He has decided to move back to Mwabi village to be closer to them. He tells me people there no longer make fun of him now that he has money of his own. What are you going to do now? I ask him. Tell me about your dreams now that you're free. He gets excited and spreads his arms wide. My translator nods seriously and then speaks in his monotone. He says he will open a store. A big store with lots of food the people in his village haven't seen. Then there's another moment of translation, a conferring across time and language. And my translator says he wants to start with one small store, but then he says he will collect the money to expand it to many. And so, after 20 years of being hurtled around Southeast Asia, after hiking literal mountains, parting literal seas, losing his friends and limbs and all his hope many times over, after being enslaved and overseeing slaves himself, Tun Lin is heading back to his home state to build a grocery chain. Acknowledgements. This book would have been impossible without the contributions of what, by the end, felt like a true community of entrepreneurs, analysts, activists, academics, and hardworking grocery professionals, all devoted in some way or another to understanding the chaotic ways we Americans feed. Accordingly, a few thanks to those who made this project possible. Thank you to Joe and Alice Colomb for letting me into their Trader Joe's adventure, and to Lynn Riles for allowing me into her truck and life. To Julie Boucher for explaining every important thing in this industry twice while simultaneously being one of the kindest, smartest, and hardest working people I've ever met. Thank you to Walter for being such a delight of a human being. Your openness, humor, and work ethic inspire. Thank you to Kevin Kelly for insight, access, and understanding. Kevin, we only scratched the surface. Thank you to Pion and Sumpong of the LPN for your hospitality, grace, and inspiration. And to Tun Lin and Sumpong Lindsay for your honesty, bravery, and witness. I tried to do you justice. Most of all, thank you to Mahate for safely taking me places I could not otherwise go. Thank you to all those who shared the ideas that define this book but requested not to be named. This project would be impossible without your willingness to speak candidly to a nosy stranger. Thank you to Leroy Watson and Robert Gwentart, to Ian Keller, to Daniel Murphy, Andy Hall, Katrina Nakamura, and Lisa Wren Taylor. Thank you to Elizabeth Aud and Desiree Ann Wood for endless patience. Stay safe out there. To translators extraordinaire Boong Sasivara, Hannah Snow, and Annie Tarr. To Phil Robertson of Human Rights Watch for patiently stitching the connection between Typhoon Gay, Thai police, and racism. To Brian Edge, Corey Pete, Lori Bishop, Simon Baker, Darian McBride, David Kawahigashi, and Josh Stride. Thank you to Mansoor Samadipur. There's a whole book on you alone. To Earl Schweizer, to Kevin Koop, to Tim Litton and Wayne Hsing, to the Whole Foods Fish Counter, winter of 2015. To Carrie Gleason and Carolyn Wheeler, thank you especially to Doug Rao and his work at the Daily Table for inspiring this project into being. Thank you to my beloved secret editors, Liz Greenwood, Sakari Jones, Stephen Fishback, Rachel McKean, Missy Mazzoli, and Matt Stewart. Thank you to Elena Graydon for dealing with overflow crazy via tacos and text, and to Cecilia Watson for handling emergency grammar questions with aplomb. Thank you especially to Rachel Corbett, a champion of sanity, voice of compassion, my edit hero of 2019. Thank you to my indispensable real editors, Pam Krause for acquiring this thing and encouraging it, Laura Appleton for shepherding, crafting, nudging, and hassling it into completion. Lauren, I'm both sorry for my stubbornness and tremendously grateful for your persistence plowing through it. The book is so much better for it. Thank you to Mary and Lizzie for your wisdom, scrutiny, and strong puns along the way. I am indebted to all of your eyes and insights, saving me from blunders and elevating my arguments. Thank you to Mike Harriott, agent, stalwart, and kind, calm, unflinching voice of reason on the phone. Thank you to the McDowell Colony and the Corporation of Yaddo, where critical parts of this book were completed. To Marion, Cheryl, David Blake, and whoever thought to put a bathtub next to a screened porch in Calderwood. To Katrina Trask and her giant white room, thank you to the Allen Room Residency at the New York Public Library, because sometimes free office space is worth more than inspiration. Thanks to Athis and Kat, Sol and Ash, Raj and Joe, Scott and Liz, Nod and Mike, Stephen and Julia, Josh and Julie, Matt and Witt, Mike and Lauren, John and Renana, Josh and Katie, David and Carla. You are anchors and guiding lights. To Joe Rowe and the rest of the Creaky Joint Rollers Marathon crew, thanks to mycologists Scott and Keenan, life examined with you two is life worth living. Thanks to Victoria for starting this with me way back when. Thanks to Vadis for all good things along the way. Finally, thanks to my sister, Sarah Lohr, for being the best. And for Adam Blumenkrantz for becoming family. Thanks to Franny the dog for keeping us all sane. And most of all to Kathy and Richard Lohr, the two best parents a guy could ever ask for. I love you more than you know. You're my sun, moon, earth, and stars. This concludes the reading of The Secret Life of Groceries, The Dark Miracle of the American Supermarket by Benjamin Lohr. Copyright 2020 by Benjamin Lohr. This book was read by Benjamin Lohr. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Folio Literary Management, LLC, and was produced in 2020 by Blackstone Publishing, which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Publishing. If you'd like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.